KBOO is a proud sponsor of One Flaming Arrow, Intertribal Film Festival 2016, bringing Native American and Indigenous independent film to Portland, Oregon, July 28th through the 31st. Opening night at Clinton Street Theater with showings through the weekend at Hollywood Theater and Rainmaker Gallery. Please consider supporting independent media. More information can be found at oneflamingarrow.com.
Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Mary Beth Grabel, the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art at the Portland Art Museum. And Mary Beth is here to talk about Splashes of Color, Chinese woodblock prints from the Yuwei Dojai collection. Thanks for coming to KBOO, Mary Beth.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
This exhibition is based on a private collection from Seattle, and it's color woodblock prints, about which I don't think we know a lot in the West. The Chinese are known for early printing in black and white books, but this incredibly detailed and sophisticated color printing is in this exhibition starts in the 1600s and goes through the 20th century. So just tell us why this is so special.
Many of us in the West, both Europe and North America, are familiar with Japanese prints. These started coming in, one thinks particularly to Paris, but later to North America in the late 19th century. And Japanese prints are very widely published, enormous numbers of collections in the West. Probably everyone has seen a Japanese print of a beautiful woman or a kabuki actor or a hiroshige or hokusai landscape. But Chinese woodblock prints were not made as single sheets to be sold very, very cheaply. Chinese color prints were made in books to be an elegant, exquisite object, really an art object, and the target audience was the educated elite. So that meant that they were less likely to leave China, and an appreciation of them acquires some appreciation of the Chinese literary culture that goes behind them. So there are a few hurdles to get over to appreciate the background, but what people will see in this exhibition is that the artistic qualities are so stunning that one is immediately seduced.
In the first room, at least, you're going to be seeing in a frame a sheet of paper with a poem on the left and usually a drawing of a rock or a plant or something on the right. Now, just tell us, how do these poems and images get matched up?
The exhibition begins with different printings, not different editions, but slightly different printings of the earliest great masterpiece of color woodblock printing, which was a book issued in several volumes, I think 8 volumes, called The Ten Bamboo Studio Collection of Calligraphy and Painting. That's a big mouthful in English, but it's faster in Chinese. The Ten Bamboo Studio Collection of Calligraphy and Painting. And this is the brainchild of one brilliant, innovative fellow who was an artist, a seal carver, a publisher in Nanjing, China's second largest city, for centuries a center of politics, education, learning. His name was Hu Jiangyan. He had done some other publishing projects, but he had this idea to sort of share with a wider group, a wider public, his love of paintings. So over the course of several years, we think he spent close to 2 decades sort of getting this whole project ready. He persuaded 30-some artists to make designs, and then each volume had a different topic. So one might be orchids, One might be chrysanthemums. One might be scholars' rocks. And these are the kinds of topics, these nature studies, are done by very often scholar amateur painters in what we call China's literati painting tradition. So he had them do designs that would be the size of the final book page that he wants. So it's about 10 by 10 inches, very roughly. And then he went, once those images are ready, the paintings are ready, he went to almost 130 people, sometimes very famous calligraphers, sometimes people that are just passing through town. And he asked them to both compose and then do the calligraphy for verses to accompany the paintings. So that was the plan, that he would have pictures and poems alternating. And I think the original book had well over 350 pages, again, in about 8 volumes. And what we see in the exhibition is something that is extremely rare. I don't know if it exists anywhere else. We have pages of matching poems and pictures before they were even bound in books. In other words, there's no centerfold. So it's utterly pristine condition.
There are combinations of rocks and plants. And there's one which is an orchid, which seems to be growing from behind a rock. There's another one that's a banana plant growing sort of on a rock, with a very square banana leaf. Where do you think those came from?
Well, these are the kinds of subjects that one found in Ming Dynasty painting. That's painting in China from mid-14th to the mid-17th century. And very often, what you would see in a Chinese painting is an artist is not going to paint a horizon line or a ground line. If it's a nature study that looks at a plant, you have a rock that sort of is your substitute. That sort of establishes the ground line. So you have a rock and then the plants near that. And that becomes a little grouping of a nature study. And in the two works that you spoke of, they're wonderful examples of how the colors in these editions that are on view in the exhibition are very true to the original intentions. And you can see, for example, in the orchid leaf, this wonderful, long, twisting, elegant orchid leaf that they printed so that the color of the leaf changes as it gets towards the outer edge, as often happens with the plant. The outer edge is drying a little bit and looks a little bit rusty, whereas it's greener back to the root. That is just such an elegant touch. Mm-hmm. So one is really, your breath is taken away by the sophistication of the printing.
And the composition of that is the rock is in the bottom left, and then right. You just have these three strands that almost take up, well, they go into the right side right. of the big
yes.
empty space.
Yes. In Chinese painting, this is called a one-corner composition, and it's a composition that you get. Anyway, it's been around for centuries by the time we get to this 1633 print. And so what's wonderful about it is the rock, you sort of imagine the rock is in the foreground near you, and then the plant that stretches to the other corner of the painting invites your mind. You sort of have this ineffable, unlimited void. And so it's quite deliberate to leave that as suggestion rather than spelling it out.
And in this example, there is an inscription down on the right side. What is that?
In this case, it just tells you the species of orchid.
Oh, okay.
So one contemporary said of Hu Zhengyan's Ten Bamboo Studio that flipping the pages was like walking through an elegant garden.
Mm-hmm. So then in the other room, we have it's divided into two categories. There is a book about how to paint, and then there is stationery, so fancy letter paper. So tell us about the instruction manual of how to paint.
The what you're referring to is the Mustard Seed Garden Manual of Painting. And Mustard Seed Garden, like the word Ten Bamboo Studio, is just the name that the publisher gave his own home workshop, we might say, a compound. And this is again published in Nanjing. Now, initially in 1671, with a few more volumes coming out in 1701, so a gap there. But this is, again, not not one person, but a group of friends getting together. There was a very, very well-known playwright who encouraged an artist that he knew to compile these images, and then he got his son-in-law to publish them. So the idea here is that it's not just a collection of paintings, but that what has been assembled is very deliberately to teach people how to paint. And what may be hard for us to understand is that in China, where the instrument for doing a painting is the same brush that's done for calligraphy, almost anyone who is literate might enjoy doing painting as a hobby. Mm-hmm. Some people take it seriously, but many people did it as part of self-cultivation. So there is, by the time late 17th century, when Mustard Seed is published, probably an enormous audience of people who are interested in painting for fun. And this volume shows them step by step how to paint an orchid, how to paint bamboo. And it's we all sort of saw, you know, those picture books, how to paint a cat, how to paint a horse when we were children. But this is very, in very specific Chinese terms, it's sort of the brushstrokes used to evoke a particular shape or natural object. Mm-hmm. And so you might have plants, but you also have models of different types of architecture, different types of figures, and even, in one case, a book of landscapes. And for that, they must have found someone who had excellent knowledge of the great painting collections in southern China, looked at those paintings or knew them intimately, and he would create on a page that's 6 inches wide and 10 inches tall a miniature version of a famous landscape with a characteristic brushwork of that artist going back to the 11th century. And so this, it's almost like Janssen's History of Art. You know, you could flip through the pages and see this. But this becomes so popular and so important that artists throughout China who were in provincial regions that don't have important painting collections, they looked at this and taught themselves how to paint. And it's even imported into Japan, and where it was incredibly popular. And in 1748, a publisher in Kyoto cut apart a Chinese book, recut the blocks, and reissues it in Japan. He doesn't plagiarize. He says that it's from China, but it even gets reissued in Japan.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Mary Beth Graybill. She's the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art at the Portland Art Museum, and she's here talking about Splashes of Color, Chinese woodblock prints from the Yo Wei Du Jai collection. Mary Beth, so you were just talking about this manual, which presume is a lot more accessible than the sort of fine literary prints we were talking about before. This would have been mass produced.
I think,
or is
this,
it like a textbook?
Well, I think it's certainly envisioned as a textbook or a guide. The first two volumes that came out in 1671 are modest technically. They tend to have maybe a black block and then a shading block that's gray. But when they come out with a second group of birds, flowers, insects in 1701, then it's much more ambitious and they use a lot more colors, but it still has this strong instruction manual flavor to it. I'm not so certain how many issues would have been done when it's first published in those years. But what we can say about Mustard Seed, it's so popular that it keeps getting published, you know, issued over and over again until the blocks completely wear out. So it was obviously tremendously popular.
And then it showed up in Japan where they did their own take on it.
Yes, yes. And what's fun about the Japanese volume, if you look at it, everything about it looks to be Chinese. The original compilers and artists and so forth are all named exactly as they are in the Chinese volume. It's only the very front page that names the Kyoto publisher who recut it. So what we see here is a Japanese publisher working mightily and largely succeeding in copying this multicolor sophisticated Chinese method of printing. It's not quite up to the snuff of the best Chinese printings, but it's very good, and it's much better than what the Japanese had done before. So this imported book pushes Japanese printing technology. It's a quantum leap.
And these inscriptions in this book, are they in Chinese or Japanese?
Yes, they're in Chinese.
Okay.
Which Japanese could read.
Oh, could they?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Japanese writing system uses Chinese characters. And if you're an educated Japanese, historically, you'd be able to read classical Chinese.
Right. So, yeah, the printing isn't quite as good. There's a bit of, you know, coloring outside the lines, as you put it.
They're not quite as successful with what we would call registration.
Mm-hmm.
Close, but not quite. And the shading isn't quite as sophisticated as in the best Chinese printings, but it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. So people in Japan were fascinated with this book. And what did they do? Where does this take Japanese printing?
Well, two things. It inspires Japanese to do more complex, more ambitious color printing. But the other tremendous impact that Mustard Seed Garden Manual has in Japan is that there's a whole coterie, large group of painters in cities like Kyoto and Osaka and Western Japan who teach themselves how to paint from this book, and you get their paintings are kind of pastiches of motifs from this, and eventually they figure out better how to organize a composition. But it really breathes fresh life into Japanese painting in the 18th century.
And is that brings us to our vision of what Japanese painting is?
Well, within Japan, those painters and that group of painters would be called either literati painting, which was taking the name from the Chinese word, or sometimes it's called nanga, Southern school painting, again, which was the name by which it's known in China. So their identity as painters is very clearly they're indicating that their style is influenced by China, and they set themselves apart that way.
Mm-hmm. So you've traced that kind of influence. And then the third part of the exhibition is about letter paper. So it's literally beautiful writing paper.
Yes.
And envelopes.
Yes.
But this is a revival in the 1930s. So it's
right.
20th century revival of a Japanese take on a Chinese
No. It's a 20th century revival of a very old Chinese tradition.
So it's Chinese on Chinese.
Yes.
Right. And what spirit do you think they were reviving? Were they being avant-garde, or was it a kind of backlash nationalist thing?
I wouldn't say backlash. We know that Chinese were producing beautiful papers, decorated papers, for example, for Buddhist sacred texts as far back as the 8th century. Sometimes that means dyed paper. Maybe it would have a printed or stamped designs. Actually, this is sort of stamping before printing. It might have marbleized ink designs. But making paper beautiful for a special text is a very ancient idea. And there are beautiful letter papers for writing poetry, but also letters, important letters, going back in documents to at least 11th century. So it's an old tradition. And the same man, Hu Zhengyan, who did the Ten Bamboo Studio, also published a volume of letter paper designs. And what happens in the 1920s and 30s is that some of the most prominent intellectuals, Lu Xun, probably the most famous author of the 20th century China, and some of his friends, come across these Ming Dynasty books, collections of letter papers, and they say, "This is fabulous. This is fabulous. We got to do something about this." And they say, "You know, I think that there are publishers in Beijing who could create color woodblock printing of this quality." So Lu Xun and his friend, working with the Rongbao Jai studio in Beijing, initially produce a small little volume in limited editions that revives the Ming Dynasty book. And it's so amazingly popular that said, okay, this is a commercially viable thing to do. So the publishing house then commissions several of the most famous painters in China at the time, working in Beijing, people with names like Chi Bai Shi, Pu Ru, and so forth. They commissioned them to make designs for letter paper. So they're actually executing a painting, but letter paper size.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Rongbaojie studio uses their technique to turn that into a print.
Right.
And this might be produced in a collection, in a book. So we have on exhibition a double volume book that they produced. So if you just wanted to collect them as beautiful designs, mm-hmm. you could have it as a beautiful book on your shelf. Or you can see in the exhibition sheets of stationery and sheets of paper done. And the designs are wonderful. One of the most memorable designs shows a mouse eating grapes.
Mm-hmm. So you have these laid out
flat
a flat case.
Yes.
So you're looking down on them and they're literally, you know, sheets of letter paper.
Right.
But there are three with a mouse design.
Right.
All different. So all done by different artists.
Yes.
And the one on the far left is a fat mouse with three grapes.
With three grapes, so yes.
Who did that?
That's Chi Bai Shi.
And he was like the Andy Warhol of his day?
I would say absolutely, absolutely. Or the it was very avant-garde. If one looks at Chi Bai Shi's work, and you can clearly recognize this in the exhibition and the prints based on his paintings, his late style, and by the time we get to the 1930s, he's I think well past 50, is very loose, very rapid, very spontaneous, and people loved it. And so for China at the time, this is defining modernism. It's getting away from sort of fussy, tiny, or tidy brushwork. Now, this same publishing house did these exquisite, tidy, you know, they did those designs as well. But Chi Bai Shi's bravado, really, brushwork was very hot, very, very sexy. And that wonderful mouse, just, you know, these quick washes, a few lines, but it's so spontaneous and it so captures this vitality of the mouse. But you would buy, as you say, it comes with two other mouse designs, so three artists, and you would buy that in a box set that maybe you get 15 sheets of each mouse.
Mm-hmm. And these are, just to go back, he painted the mouse with a brush,
right.
So it looks like a watercolor.
Yes.
And then somebody managed to print that and make it look like a watercolor.
Right. And the paintings and the prints are actually using the same pigments. They're water-based pigments. And in fact, before the terminology, quote, woodblock print, unquote, was established, one publishing house in Beijing actually called them woodblock water prints because they were thinking about the fact that it's water-based pigments.
Right. So there are other ones that have flowers as a sunflower.
Yes.
And they're in book form. This is the version you would buy if you just wanted to treat them as art.
Right. Or if you wanted to have a 70 rather than, you know, a loose sheet. The Rongbaojie, it was a very clever publishing idea, but it also goes back to those 17th century books that we saw, to take all the designs and compile them in a book, and then you have it on your shelf and bring it down and simply enjoy it as a beautiful art book.
Mm-hmm. And then you do have example of you have people have written letters on
yes.
them, so you can see how they would have ended up. Now, my curiosity is, are these like super important letters between diplomats? Are they love letters? Or are they just letters that would be thrown away?
They're not letters between diplomats. These are, in a certain sense, too intimate for something like that. The scale is an intimate scale. But we can imagine that just as we might go into a sort of slightly better than usual stationery store and look for a beautiful box of thank you cards to have on hand, and then we send thank you notes to people when we've gotten wonderful presents or Christmas time or something, you look for a, you know, you can spend a great deal of money buying a beautiful greeting card. We can imagine it as something like that. And in the same way, some people might keep them because it's a beautiful design or they treasure the content of the letter. So we have in the exhibition two letters, one written in Chinese and actually one written in Japanese, but on Chinese letter paper. And what might be surprising to people is they blithely write all over the design. So they don't feel constrained to go around the edges of the picture. So that helps us understand the purpose of the stationery too.
The postcard image is a man on a donkey. Looks like he's, I thought he was going off a cliff, but he's actually just going around round the side of a cliff on a path. And there's some writing. What is that piece?
Yes, the image that we have sort of blown up so that you can see it from a distance and invites you into the gallery is a charming landscape by Puru. Puru's name is known and cherished by fans of 20th century Chinese painting. He was actually a member of the imperial family of the Qing dynasty. He was a cousin of the last Qing emperor. But he chose to become he was originally an amateur painter, but then focused more and more on that. And so in the 30s, when these letter papers are being done in Beijing, he's one of the artists asked to contribute to the project. Later, he would move to Taiwan and become a very important teacher. But this is a Peru landscape. And as you say, we have a gentleman riding a donkey in kind of a barren landscape. We have a cliff and a single tree, but wonderful colors. There's a rich sort of deep blue and a wonderful soft pink rose. That and the grays of various shades of gray. And that gray and black ink and rose and blue is also the traditional palette of literati painting. So here you have a miniature painting, maybe 10 inches by 7 inches, reproduced in print as a very beautiful piece of stationery.
And what does the text say?
I haven't tried to decipher all of that.
What might it say?
It's probably, in this case, a poem by the artist about the subject of traveling in nature. It may be intended to evoke a well-known poet traveling through the countryside.
This show is pretty rare.
Yes, we're really thrilled to have an opportunity to present this material, and I should emphasize how grateful we are to the Yowei Jijai Collection in Seattle for sharing this with us. But it's my understanding that this is only the second time that there has been an exhibition in North America devoted exclusively to Chinese woodblock prints. It's, in many senses, still a new field and an exciting field, and I hope that people will recognize how beautiful it is once they come and see the show.
I think people might put their head in the gallery and see a sort of dim room with Chinese prints on the wall and maybe just duck out straight away because there's a big splashy fashion show next door.
Yes,
but
yes.
You can learn an incredible amount in a short time about the history of printing here and the relation between China and Japan. Probably could inspire, young artists.
I certainly hope so.
My name's Joseph Galvin and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Mary Beth Graybill. She's the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art at the Portland Art Museum. And she was here talking about splashes of color, Chinese woodblock prints from the Yowei Dojai collection. And that runs through October the 9th. Thank you for coming into KBOO, Mary Beth.
Thank you again. It's my pleasure.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on. Hey!
Tune in every first Tuesday of the month at 6 o'clock for Transpositive PDX.
We are a radio collective seeking out news, information, and discussion within Portland's diverse populations of intersex, transgender, and non-binary communities. On July 5th, we'll have multiple guests, including local doctor Angela Carter. We'll discuss hormone replacement therapies and how they affect our bodies and minds.
We will also talk to Detroit's trans woman rap artist, Amber Byers, also known as Detroit's D-Slim.
That is on Tuesday, July 5th, from 6 to 7 p.m.
Find us on KBOO.FM.
And on Station 90.7, KBOO Portland.